This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. Time now for the Outdoorsman Radio Show with your host, Alan Ellis. Good morning, everybody. Alan Ellis here. This is the Outdoorsman Radio Show. We talk about fishing, hunting, and the great outdoors, and we invite you to participate by giving us a call right here at WCBM 680. That is our phone number. WCBM 680 is our phone number. Put a 410 in front of it, and you've got it. Numerically, it's 410-922-6680. That's 410-922-6680 for those of you who are alphabetically and textually challenge. We will just go ahead and translate that into numbers for you. If you're outside the local Baltimore dialing area, give us a call at 800-922-6680 with any questions, comments that you might have about the great outdoors, any fishing adventures that you might have had. If you'd like to talk about hunting, we'll be glad to do that too. Season's right around the corner. But this morning, we have a guest with us this morning, Rudy Lukakovic. Did I say that correctly?
You did, I don't think.
Oh, man, I'll tell you, I'm getting much better. Of course, I grew up in Western Pennsylvania, you know, Pittsburgh and all that, you know, so I learned how to pronounce similar names in my ute.
Yep. Eastern European names, yes.
Eastern European names, that's correct. Lukakovic, I like it. fisheries biologist with Maryland Department of Natural Resources, emeritus, or retired, which is it?
Retired 1 year, yes.
Retired 1 year, yes, indeed. And the big celebration they surprised you with this week, and I thought that was pretty clever to do it that way. Why give the guy a retirement party when he retires? Wait a year and surprise him.
It was an anniversary, yes.
That's right, anniversary. Your name comes up every now and then on the radio show. I think Marty took your name in vain here a couple weeks ago.
It's not unusual.
And we were talking about catch and release. Mm-hmm. You were the guy that did years, I guess, worth of studies on catch and release fishing, particularly in striped bass in Chesapeake Bay.
Yep, it was, I guess, the mid-1990s we got the opportunity to begin doing this work, and we started off with hickory shad. And the reason we did that study was Dr. Jim Guilford, who was the chairman of the Sport Fish Advisory Commission in those days, was concerned because hickory shad had seemed to make a comeback. They were showing up in greater numbers than they had been seen in many years in both Octorero and Deer Creek. And concurrent with that population rebound, angling activity, even though it was at the time was illegal to target them, anglers were targeting herring and catching hickory shad. And Dr. Guilford was concerned that this angling activity might jeopardize what appeared to be a population recovery if there was a high rate of angler-induced mortality. So he requested that we do a study, which we did, with the help of Dale, formerly from Denton, currently from Easton. He sent me up with a bunch of anglers who...
Dale would know about... I mean, now he knows him by name.
Yes, he does. He's an expert is probably an understatement when it comes
exactly.
to shad for Dale.
Yep.
But he sent me with these anglers, and we did a study which showed mortality to be extremely low. So therefore, they changed the regulation to allow catch-and-release fishing for that particular species.
Mm-hmm. Particularly fly fishing, I guess, was one of the preferred methods to fish hickory shad. Gotcha. Oh, goody. Let's talk to Judy in Lutherville. She wants to talk about black bears. Wonder why. Judy, good morning. Hello, Judy. Hello, Judy. Where'd Judy get to? Well, Judy's still there? I don't know where Judy got to. Let's see if we can find her. I guess she went away. She had to wait all 13 seconds, really, before we went to her. So, Judy, give us a call back. We'd love to talk about bears in Lutherville and everywhere else they've been sighted in this part of Maryland this week. So you started with hickory shad. Tell me how that study was conducted. And I'm sure they're all similar to that, but give our audience an idea of how you study hook mortality with hickory shad. First of all, you got to catch one.
First, you have to catch one, and then you need to observe the fish after release to see if it does survive. With hickory shad, as we did with American shad the following year, white perch and yellow perch, we did shore-based tank studies. We set up two 350-gallon tanks on the shoreline and had a system of water coming from the stream into the tanks and back out again, a flow-through system. And we had anglers catch fish for us using standard methods. We try to keep everything as consistent as possible.
Sure.
And then just observe the fish for a set period of time to see if mortality does occur. And we held the hickory shad and the American shad for 48 hours. And with a hickory shad, we saw no mortality. We did 10 trials using 150 fish. So we felt that hickory shad that are caught and released by a reasonably conscientious angler would not experience an unacceptable level of mortality. We did see some dead fish in the stream which had physical damage compatible with hook wounds. We can't say for certain that angling killed them. But based upon the results of our study, in addition to being caught and released, they were also transported and confined, which represents additional stress that's not associated with catch and release fishing. So we felt the study indicates that a fish caught and released by, say, a reasonably conscientious angler is going to do okay.
That's hickory shad. Now let's talk black bears. Good morning, Judy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
How are you doing?
I want to talk about the black bears.
Okay. Did you see one? Did you see one?
Well, yeah, I had a side lot that's never been developed, so it's at any given night we have about 30 deer or something.
Sure.
A little reunion on it. But about 3 weeks ago, I thought I saw a black bear.
Okay.
My next-door neighbor says, oh, you probably saw a deer.
Mm-hmm.
Deer do not climb trees.
Usually not, no.
And
for the most part, no.
They're very prolific in New Jersey. I'm thinking this reminds me when they started selling off the farmland around Baltimore County, and we're all wondering, oh, are the poor little deer going to be able to assimilate?
Yeah.
We're the ones that are having the problem assimilating.
Yeah, the deer are doing just fine.
And I was going to plant a garden.
Yeah.
A vegetable garden. Well, that's going to just attract more of the black bears because there's little babies that are foraging looking for food.
Yeah.
So they're going to be fighting with the deer.
Yeah, so you're pretty convinced you did see a black bear.
Oh, I know I did.
Yeah. Well, now you know they've been reporting them in Baltimore County.
Yeah.
In the news the last couple of days. And in Lutherville there, actually, I don't know if it was maybe 2 years ago, 3 years ago, one was actually spotted in Lutherville. It got out of a dumpster in one of the restaurants there along York Road, wandered out onto the Beltway, and got struck on the Beltway right there in Lutherville.
I mean, I don't wish it evil, but that's a good thing.
But what?
I thought, oh my God!
Oh, I like bears. I like the
my trash cans.
Okay, we can't both talk at the same time. Go ahead. What were you going to say?
Give me the good old days when all I had to do was fly with the raccoons over my trash can.
Oh yeah, I know about that. Trust me, I had an encounter last night. So. You know, that's how it goes. But when we move into where they live, it's not them moving into where we live. We've already moved into their neighborhood, and
exactly.
they were there first. So
exactly.
Well, I'm glad you called, Judy. I appreciate that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. And, Judy, I don't think you're crazy. I think you saw a bear. There she goes. Donna in Pasadena. Good morning, Donna. How are you?
Good morning.
Yes, ma'am.
Concerned. We back up to woods, and you're absolutely right. The animals were here first.
Yep.
There was a kit fox under my pine tree, and it wasn't acting right. When I first noticed it, it was on its, side, like a cat would do when it's, relaxing or sunning itself. Okay, it raised its head a couple of times. Then it got up on all fours, but it couldn't stay up. So then it flopped down on the ground again. It was in the opposite direction, and it, how they do, it curled its tail around and flopped its head, over its tail. And I watched it for a good 45 minutes. So then I decided I called the non-emergency Anne Arundel County police number.
Mm-hmm.
They referred me to animal
control, right.
And animal control referred me to DNR.
Right.
The dispatcher down, I said, where are you located? He says, I'm down near Sandy Point.
Right.
Because I knew it was an Annapolis number I was calling.
Right.
So he said, we'll see who we have in the area to dispatch.
Right.
Well, within 10 minutes, an Anne Arundel County police officer came.
Right.
But by the time he came, the animal had gotten up. And again, it headed towards the woods.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, acting disoriented. And, you know, I couldn't, through the one, the right side of my pine tree I can see.
Right.
Through the left side, it's fuller. So I couldn't really, you know.
Yeah.
Watch it. So, of course, your first thought is rabies.
That's probably a good thought.
I called the lady next door to me, and I, you know, when the thing was still under my tree, I said, could you please go out on your deck and see if you can see it, make some noise, because I had been banging on my window,
right,
blowing and a little whistle. I mean, you know, normally an animal would...
Yeah, they're going to go. Yeah.
They're going to go. So she told me... she did that for me, and she said she looked over the fence, and it didn't budge. And, I mean, this is a 6 foot high.
Did you tell me this is an adult fox, a full-grown fox?
No, I think it was a kid fox, because it was.
You mean a pup?
A baby, yeah.
Yeah, okay. A kid fox is a different species.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, that's all right.
It's a whole species?
A kit fox is a different species. You were seeing was probably a young red fox.
It was, exactly.
And, you know, you could have had rabies. I suspect it probably had a parvovirus as opposed to rabies. The way it was working, the fox population is highly susceptible to parvo.
It's like dogs.
Exactly.
Oh,
okay. So, you know, in that situation, now you said disoriented and things like that, which, yeah, your first thought would run to rabies, but not necessarily. We almost had our Maryland fox population wiped out about 15 years ago because of a extremely hot parvovirus that was killing the pups in the dens.
Oh my goodness!
So we're familiar with that. So that's a possibility. I mean, you don't have to automatically jump to rabies, although that's one of the vector species.
Okay. Yeah, it seemed to be trying to swallow and having difficulty swallowing. Yeah, but you know, like I say, it was just out there, you know.
Yeah.
Not.
Well, you had every right to be concerned and every right to call animal control. I hope there are no domestic animals around there.
Oh my goodness! Of course.
That's what I thought. Yeah.
And I called my neighbor on the corner who has two dogs. The lady that you know banged on the fence for me.
Yeah.
They're going to watch her son's Yorkies.
Yeah.
Next week.
Yeah, wow. Well, it's always something to be concerned about because you know that disease is spread primarily through saliva. And, you know, if that animal has eaten or if you have outside water bowls or something like that, or, you know, you feed your animals outside, you know, keep your eye on it. That's all I can tell you.
Oh, gosh. Okay. Another thing, again, my neighbor next door who banged on her fence told me that there was a dead fox found in the garage right across the street. And she says she thinks they disposed of it just by putting it in a trash bag and putting it in the regular trash.
Yeah. Well, usually once it's dead, it's, you know, the danger's pretty
gone.
Much over. Yeah. So.
Okay. The animal's dead. So.
Yeah. But I certainly wouldn't get in touch with any of the body fluids if you can help it. So, and you know, if you do find that, you know, wear a pair of gloves and throw them away.
I don't really want it to.
Well, I don't blame you. I don't blame you. Well, you know, handle it like you would handle, you know, doggy do. Reach down inside the bag and pick it up and then turn it inside out and wrap the bag and chuck it.
I hear you, but okay. Well, no, my dog expired. We had to put him down 17 years ago.
Yeah.
Or, you know, cancer, sarcoma.
Yeah.
So I don't have an animal, you know, at present.
Right. Well, I mean, like.
That's interesting that it could be parvo.
Yeah. Very, very possible.
So as long as dogs have their parvo shots, not a problem.
Pretty much, yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hey, Donna, thanks for the call.
One last question, if I might.
All right.
Do you think that I need to be in touch with animal control again on Monday?
You know, it might not hurt to touch base with them, tell them what's going on in the neighborhood, tell them if they're in the area to you know, kind of keep a watch out. I guess I don't know what I would do other than that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether they're actually going to reply and respond, I don't know.
I would wonder myself.
There you go. So.
Okay, Parvo, that's very interesting.
So maybe here's your homework assignment for next week. Google parvovirus and see if the animal was exhibiting any of its symptoms.
I don't have a computer.
Uh-oh.
Okay. I hear you.
All right. Thanks, Donna.
All right.
Bye-bye. There she goes. What do you think, Rudy? Parvo or rabies?
When she described the animal having difficulty swallowing, I thought of rabies,
yeah.
Hydrophobia right away. But again, you know, I'm sure symptoms being diagnosed over the phone is probably a good idea.
Yeah, swallowing is certainly true. I mean, an animal will gulp water, try to go to water with hydrophobia is what you're doing. So let's see what happens. Well, all right, we managed to talk about Hickory Shad, but now we need a little break. And it is time for the Maryland Fishing Challenge. You know, you, my listeners, could win great prizes like the grand prize boat, motor, and trailer rig from Bass Pro Shop, or even thousands in tackle from Bill's Outdoor Center, maybe even a vacation from the World Fishing Network. From now through Labor Day, all you have to do is go fishing. If you're lucky enough to catch a Maryland citation-sized fish and certify your catch, you're in. It's that easy. There are more than 60 species of fish in freshwater, tidal rivers, Chesapeake Bay, and on the Atlantic coast to qualify. Now stop by your local fishing citation center or visit www.dnrmaryland.maryland.gov. That's dnr.maryland.gov for all the details in the 2012 Maryland Fishing Challenge. This year we honor Lefty Cray. As a matter of fact, Monday they'll name part of the NPR trail for Lefty Cray. They're on the gunpowder. And don't forget, Diamond Jim's out there, too. He's out there swimming around. He's worth $10,000 if you catch him by the end of June. Lots of imposters out there, too. Even they're worth $500. So if you catch a rockfish with a bright green tag, call that number on the tag. You might just have captured a $10,000 prize in the Maryland Fishing Challenge. That's www.dnr.maryland.gov. Are you feeling lucky?
W&W Tire and Auto Service in Finksburg has taken care of my trucks for over 25 years. Anything from a simple oil change to extensive engine work, brakes, tune-ups, everything, their motto is, we do it. Bridgestone and Firestone tires for pickups, SUVs, and commercial vehicles. Large trucks, motorhomes, even diesel engines are no problem. W&W Tire and Auto Service on Route 140, 3233 Baltimore Boulevard in Finksburg. Look for the big American flag. Call for an appointment, 410-833-8410. W&W Tire and Auto.
Hey, Judy was from Pasadena. I'll tell you who else is from Pasadena. Fishbones Bait and Tackle, 4729 Mountain Road in Pasadena, Maryland. You just take Route 100 all the way to the end where it hits Mountain Road there. Head out towards Gibson Island. Go 2.5 miles or on the right-hand side. I was just there yesterday, as a matter of fact, and said hi to Bud. He's been having a good year with all the bait, all the tackle that's been going on, the crabbing supplies, crab season getting ready. And he's got those great big stainless steel, custom-made, stainless steel crab steamers available in a half bushel size, a bushel, and a bushel and a half. You can do a whole crab feast in one crab steamer. It's got the basket and the lid. It's the last crab steamer you're ever going to have to buy. Check it out at Fishbones Bait and Tackle, 4729 Mountain Road in Pasadena. If you want an up-to-date fishing report, give Bud a call. That number, 410-360-0573. That's 410-360-0573 for Fishbones Bait and Tackle.
Don't miss the best of Rush Limbaugh on Rush's Weekend Review every Saturday afternoon from 12 to 3 on the most powerful names in talk, Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
Cut 'em all, Jack. Cut 'em all, Jack. Cut
we're back with Rudy Lukakovich, retired fisheries biologist. We're talking about catch and release fishing, which is what a lot of us practice. You know, we're out there now fishing for striped bass. We're catching a lot of undersized fish, a lot of fun, you know, a jerk on one end of the line, waiting for a jerk on the other. And the fish are some places are running pretty small. You're not catching legal fish every cast. A lot of guys are using, you know, bucktails or using twisters. And, excuse me, some of them are using live bait. You did catch and release studies on striped bass as well, rockfish.
That is correct. We did a number of different studies because of the varied nature under which striped bass are caught.
Trolling, chumming, live lining, bucktail jigging. Okay.
Correct. Plus also we catch them in different temperature regimes, different salinity regimes. And it's a whole lot different than the hickory shad, American shad, and perch studies because those fisheries are basically
static. I mean, it's the same thing every time. I mean, you're going to catch a yellow perch, and yellow perch run, a white perch, and a white perch run.
Right. One study with replicates over time to take into account normal seasonal changes in temperature is sufficient, but stripers present a whole bunch of different scenarios.
Right. Okay. So where did you start? I'm sure you sat down and said, we want to do a catch and release study on striped bass. And somebody said, well, where do you want to start? And Rudy goes, I don't know.
We started back in the 90s when the moratorium was first lifted. We had a very high size limit in the springtime of 28 and then 26 inches.
Right.
And people fishing for those fish in those days were chumming. And they were releasing probably 90% of what they caught because they were undersized.
Right.
And a lot of dead fish showing up in areas where chumming activity was pretty prevalent got the charter boat captains and regular fishermen and the DNR concerned about all these dead fish.
All the floaters, huh?
All the floaters. And we did examinations on them. We found either hooks left in place or physical damage compatible with hooking on like 90% plus of the fish that we found dead. So we did a study just looking at the mortality rate of fish that were caught by chumming and then what we could do to reduce mortality from those factors.
Right.
And the single most important factor affecting striped bass as well as other fish is deep hooking. So there's a charter boat captain named Bob Spohr who's no longer with us, unfortunately.
Bob, sure.
Yeah. He's the one who basically turned us on to circle hooks.
Mm-hmm.
And we started doing comparisons and saw a significant reduction in mortality through the reduction in deep hooking.
Mm-hmm.
And so we try to encourage people, if you're catching and keeping fish and he's gut hooked, it's not a problem. But like you say, with small fish, or if you're practicing catch and release fishing, you want to do what you can to minimize the deep hooking prevalence.
Right. And so the circle hook was the solution. Now there are a number of styles, two styles, let's say, of circle hooks, a number of sizes of those hooks. The offset and the non-offset, and the offset, of course, has the point cocked to one side. The non-offset is a straight circle. Did you find a difference in the two?
Yeah, we did, and it surprised me. When we did these studies with circle hooks versus J-hooks, I gave presentations to a lot of different fishing groups, one of whom was the Maryland Charter Boat Association.
Right.
And as you can imagine, they were not my most receptive audience.
No, I'm sure.
Here I'm telling them that circle hooks are an effective way to reduce deep hooking. You definitely will kill fewer fish with circle hooks. One of the reasons being you're going to catch fewer fish. They're
right.
Not as effective. That wasn't a good selling point.
Probably not.
So Captain Ed O'Brien asked me if we would consider looking at different styles of circle hooks to see if there was one that caught better and still had a lower rate of deep hooking. So we did comparisons between offsets, non-offsets, and the wide gap Kali hooks, or Kale hooks, I'm not sure how it's pronounced.
K-A-H-L, I believe, mm-hmm.
That's correct.
Yeah.
So what surprised me is there really was no difference in the deep hooking rate between offsets and non-offsets. I expected there would be. And with the caveat, we only used circle hooks with an offset of 10 degrees. Perhaps a higher degree of offset would have been different. But there was no difference in the deep hooking rate, and surprisingly, the non-offsets were more effective in catching fish.
Hmm. So the straight non-offset hook, more effective in catching fish.
That is
people
correct.
People that use circle hooks do so because they've heard about circle hooks. They see in the requirements circle hooks, but they don't know how to fish with them very effectively. Fish takes a bait with a circle hook. you really don't set the hook. You just basically apply a little pressure and reel in. The fish tends to set the hook himself, and usually that's in a in his jaw or in his mouth somewhere where you're going to be able to unhook him.
Yeah.
Did you do any studies, and I'm sure you did, with barbless hooks?
No, I have not done barbless hooks.
We've not done barbless hooks.
That is correct.
So if you're really concerned about mortality, knowing that it's not the barb that keeps the hook, the fish on the hook, it's the bend, it's pressure on the line, it's keeping your rod up and not allowing the fish any slack, what are your thoughts on pressing down the barb on your hook?
It's certainly going to enhance survival, and it's certainly going to enhance releasing the fish.
Yeah.
And if you want to release the fish in the water in particular, which is recommended to do during periods of hot temperatures, mm-hmm. having a barbless hook would certainly facilitate that.
Yeah. Did you study any of the de-hooking methods, the little J-hook? I mean, you've seen the charter boat guys, they'll run this hooker, de-hooker down the line, this little J-hook, run it down the line and flip the fish overboard, and off it goes. Guys use forceps and, you know, little forked all kinds of different things to get the hook out. And did you study any of that?
We did not look at any de-hooking devices, no. We simply looked at mortality as it was associated with hook location, anatomical location, that sort of thing.
Yeah. So, I mean, a deep-hooked fish doesn't stand much of a chance if the hook has penetrated the esophagus.
That's true. We tried, again, to keep things consistent. So we set the definition of deep-hooked as if you looked in the fish's mouth, you could not see the point of penetration. The fish was basically gut-hooked.
Gut-hooked, swallowed the hook and bait altogether.
Correct. Okay. Fish that were deep-hooked in the mouth, we classified as shallow-hooked because no major organs were involved.
Okay.
And when you compare the mortality rates between the two groups, I think it's fairly defensible. The mortality of the deep-hooked fish is consistently around 50%, whether or not to remove the hook.
Okay.
And the shallow-hooked fish, even including the ones that were deeply hooked in the mouth, was about 3%.
3%. Okay. People will hook a fish and they'll see it bleeding. Usually that blood is associated with hooking the fish somewhere or touching the fish somewhere on the gills. Did you do anything with the gill hooks as far as, you know, that type of thing?
Yeah, we did. We had a classification for gill-hooked fish also, and we surprisingly saw very, very few. Like about out of 1,400 fish we used in these studies, we only had about 7 actually gill-hooked. But every one of those fish died.
Died, sure. Yeah, that's, I mean, you put a hole in the lungs, it's not a good thing for
exactly.
anybody. Yeah, I got you. Cool stuff, man. Very cool.
It's been interesting.
Yeah. Now, tell our listeners, let's see, what time is it? Oh, we got time. Tell our listeners what happens in a situation where you've hooked a fish, you've penetrated an internal organ. Give us the physiology, how it breaks down, why the fish dies.
It's basically blood loss. When a J-hook, they do what they're designed to do, and they do it very well. They penetrate tissue.
Mm-hmm.
They penetrate the stomach lining, and generally they hit either the heart or the liver, two organs
that'll
that have a lot
it.
Of blood flowing through
that'll
them.
That'll do it, yeah.
And it's a pretty rapid mortality. It's in the studies that we did, the mortality that we saw, 95% of the fish that died within the first 24 hours
mm-hmm.
from blood loss.
Blood loss. What about the buildup of
lactic acid?
Yes.
Surprisingly,
that comes from holding a fish out of water for a longer period of time than necessary.
It can. It's also fish that have a lot of white muscle fiber. They're ambush predators. They are not physiologically adapted to stress as easily as a fish that has more red muscle fibers. They are basically anaerobic in their activity.
Okay.
And it's been shown with other species, not striped bass necessarily, that fish that have a lot of white muscle fiber have a longer time recovering from this acid buildup called acidosis.
Right. So those would be your predator species, your what comes to mind? Northern pike.
Mm-hmm. Chain pickerel. Yep.
Chain pickerel. The
flounder.
The pike. Really?
Yeah.
Flounder.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Yeah, I guess they would be an ambush species, wouldn't they? Lay on the bottom. They got both eyes on top watching for prey. And interesting. Okay. Well, that's very cool. Very cool. What's been your take on the fishing in the bay this year?
This year is much different than other years that I've seen. I've been working as a charter boat captain, as a mate for the last 10 years part-time. And this spring was, again, 10 years is not a whole lot of perspective, but this was by far the toughest year we've seen. Opening day was great. We had a limit of 6 fish by about 9 o'clock. Since then, it's been very, very difficult.
Early spawn?
I'm guessing that's the case. The fish just are not here, yeah.
Yeah, warm water. Mm-hmm. They rolled in, they spawned, did their thing, and rolled back out. We had a report from Fishbones, as a matter of fact, of Mayworms in the bay as late as last week. I don't know if you've heard any about Upper Bay. I don't know if you heard anything about that or not.
I did not.
Yeah, which is pretty late.
It is. It is.
Obviously, they're called Mayworms for a reason. anyone who has any questions for biologist Rudy Lukacovic, not necessarily on catch and release, but what else? What other studies did you do when you were involved? I know you were involved for a long time with the department, but tell us a little bit more about the history and some of the other studies that you were involved in.
Well, I was hired in 1973, and I was hired to work with Howard King, who was a former fisheries director.
Howard, sure, yeah.
He was a project leader at the time for fish kill investigations.
Okay.
And I was hired to do that. Same time that Dale was hired to do environmental review. We started the exact same time.
Right.
And it was a great job because the variety was incredible. You could be in Garrett County one day, in Ocean City the next day. We simply responded to phone calls from people who reported dead fish. We'd have to go out and determine that indeed it was a fish kill, not just some discards, what species died, how many died, what the cause was, and if the cause was pollution of some kind, man-caused, try to find out who was responsible to supply the legal department with enough ammunition to collect some kind of reparations for the damage. And I did that until the mid-1990s when this bycatch project became available. And for some of your listeners who might not know exactly what bycatch is, it's animals like birds, reptiles, other fish that are destined to be released after being caught by both commercial and recreational fishermen. And these days, the fish that are caught and released by recreational fishermen, that's considered a bycatch issue also. So I did that for a number of years, and then the project morphed into a habitat project where we looked at fish populations and water quality in various tributaries around the bay and try to establish a link between that quality and the degree of development in those watersheds.
We have a big issue right now with water quality in the Chesapeake Bay. We had a call last week where we discussed that, and we've seen a number of fish kills in the Baltimore area. I don't know if you've been watching that, if you keep your finger on the – still keep your finger on the pulse. You're shaking your head. Yes.
Yes, I do.
And what are you looking at? What are you thinking?
Obviously, the watershed is impacted by the development as measured by impervious surface. And a lot of what – you were talking last week about not blaming the farmers, and I agree with you 100% on that. It's death by a thousand cuts. It's the development we have, it's sewage plants, it's farmers, and all of this definitely changes the flow patterns, it changes what's being introduced into the watersheds, it changes temperature. So when you have summertime, macadam is very, very hot, it rains, warm water comes into the streams that normally would be percolating in.
That's true.
So.
That's true. Well, it's not only that. Now, you said warm water. A pulse of warm water does what?
It can decrease the oxygen content because warm water is capable of holding less oxygen.
Right.
It can probably encourage the start of algae blooms. It could possibly make the water too warm for the fish to survive.
Explain what an algae bloom is and what it does and how it affects fish mortality.
Okay. It can work in one of two ways. It can work, as you were talking about before, decreasing the oxygen content of the water. Because a lot of algae, just like plants, during periods of daylight, they will photosynthesize and produce oxygen. At nighttime, they will respirate and use it up and cause fish kills by oxygen depletion. There are some algae blooms called harmful algae blooms that actually do produce toxins, like the red tides in Florida, that can kill fish.
Now, we don't have red tides here.
That is correct. We do not.
We have mahogany tides.
That is correct.
Different type of algae.
They're called dinoflagellates, and they're just different species produce different kinds of toxins.
Algae are actually not plants, is that correct?
Algae is plants. The dinoflagellates are animals.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
But they can be algae, which are plants, single cell plants.
Right.
And they can, like I say, they can produce toxins that in the red tides they kill fish down in Florida, and they can sometimes cause human health issues when these toxins become aerosolized with a lot of wave action and surf action. People inhale some of the stuff, and can get lung infections, so lung irritations.
Really? That's interesting. Let's talk to Bob in Essex. Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Good morning, Alan.
What's up?
I've got a question for your guest.
Go ahead.
This has to do with an article I found in a free publication from 1995 about DNR stocking largemouth bass and the use of hatchery in Queen Anne's County.
Okay.
And I wonder if that's still an active active program here.
Stocking largemouth bass is in an active program.
Yes, it is. The hatchery up there at Unicorn in Millington, they still are producing largemouth bass for stocking. There's ponds there that they they electrofish adults from the wild and have them spawn in these ponds, then stock the fingerlings.
Mm-hmm.
And I see in the article that they're stocked in the Chester, the Chop Tank, and Warden Creek. Are they ever stocked in Middle River? I'd love to know that question.
Not to my knowledge, there are largemouth bass in Middle River, but I do not believe they're hatchery fish. But I could be mistaken. I'm not certain about that.
Plenty of them, yeah.
Okay. Well, I know I live right near the river, and I can walk to a fishing spot and have not found the numbers yet. Is it time of year, or is it just I'm using the same techniques I've always used and have not come up with many fish in the last couple of years.
Populations ebb and flow sometimes. It's hard for me to say without actually having done a survey of Middle River, you know, years ago and compared to now. It's,
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. I mean, there are a tremendous amount of fishing tournaments over that way. There are a lot of fish that are caught and released up on the flats. I don't know if they have any impact on the area that you're fishing. I don't know the answer. I mean, there were, have always been plenty of largemouth bass in that area, but as Rudy said, you know, maybe we're facing, and maybe you're out on a post spawn, downtime or something like that. Depends on the day, I guess. Could be the weather. Could be any number of factors. You know, you might go out there today and slay them.
Right. Finally, Alan, did you mention once on the show that the size limit for the fishing challenge of largemouth bass is the same in tidal waters as it is in the freshwater?
I believe it is.
Because in the book it says 22 inches in tidal waters and it says 21 in freshwater.
Okay.
And
if that's what's in the book, it does say 21 in freshwater, and it does say 22 in the Chesapeake Bay Division. Yes, that's right. What it says.
So that is an accurate.
As far as I know, yeah. I don't know if they've changed it. I don't know if I misspoke, but why? Tell me, you caught one in caught one in freshwater that was 21 inches.
I caught a 21 inch fish 2 years ago last year actually in June.
Uh-huh.
And measured it.
Now, where did you catch it?
Right in Hog Pen Creek. Of all places.
Hogpen Creek.
Yeah, that's a little creek coming into Middle River right here in Essex.
So it's a tidal fish.
Yes.
And it was an inch short.
It was. It was a lovely fish.
Beautiful fish. Yeah.
All right,
man. Thanks, Bob.
Thank you.
Take care. There he goes. All right, we're going to take a break. Steve and Jessup wants to talk about algae, but it's time for me to tell you about our friends at Sunrooms, Inc., a new sponsor as of last week. You know, a sunroom is where you can read or entertain your friends or family year-round in a relaxing, stress-free setting. The talented craftsmen at Sunrooms, Inc., at Sunrooms Incorporated, can make your ideas come alive in a tailor-made all-season sunroom that blends with your home and provides a climate-controlled room where you can enjoy nature even on the worst days. Sunrooms, Inc. has years of experience and uses the most up-to-date, energy-efficient materials and windows. I've personally visited a Sunrooms, Inc. job site, and I've watched as they constructed a custom Energy Star-rated sunroom with a lifetime warranty for a homeowner in Anne Arundel County. It was quite a process. Simply put, Sunrooms, Inc. has the best sunroom technology, the most sunroom options, custom sunroom installation, a lifetime warranty on all of its sunrooms, and certified installers. Sunrooms, Inc. can visit you, give you an estimate anywhere in Maryland, Delaware, or southern Pennsylvania. Visit the website sunroomsinc.net. That's sunroomsinc.net, or call toll-free 800-725-1380. That's 800-725-1380. 1380 to learn more about your new sunroom.
If you're a working man and your truck breaks down, you only need to know one repair shop, W&W Tire and Auto Service in Finksburg. They built their reputation on getting you in, fixed, and out the door quickly, efficiently, and at a very competitive price. Bridgestone and Firestone tires for pickups, SUVs, and commercial vehicles, large trucks, motorhomes, even diesel engines are no problem. W&W Tire and Auto Service on Route 140, 3233 Baltimore Boulevard in Finksburg. Just look for that big American flag. Call for an appointment, 410-833-8410, W&W Tire.
Hey, what's in your bed? I mean your truck bed. Protect your truck bed with a Linex protective spray-on bedliner offered by Bay Linex of Glen Burnie. Now, Linex is the best available protective coating on the market, period. You want colors for your truck or your heavy equipment? Linex with color-coded DuPont Kevlar uses your existing paint code to provide you with that factory-finished look, offering superior protection. Linex spray-on bedliners are rated number one in customer satisfaction. Bay Linex of Glen Burnie provides a mobile service to your job site for commercial and industrial applications, too. From underground holding tanks and secondary containments to styrofoams and plastics, even your felt-soled waders, they all need protection. Linex protective coatings have been tested by the Air Force Research Lab and the Army Corps of Engineers, and now Linex even lines the walls of the Pentagon. If you'd like to know more, visit Bay Linex at Glen Burnie online at baylinex.com. That's BAYLINEX.com, or stop by the store. Bay Linex, Glen Burnie, is located at 400 Arundel Corporation Road, Bay I, just off Beltway Exit 3A. Don't be fooled by imitations. Do what I did. Protect your truck with a Linex spray-on bedliner. Call 410-789-0199. Ask for Bobby Hawkins. Mention the Outdoorsman Radio Show or Ellis Outdoors and learn how you can receive a $30 Bass Pro Shop gift card. Linex at Glen Burnie, now more than just bedliners. Now let's talk to Steve and Jessica. Morning, Steve. How you doing?
I'm doing great.
Thanks for holding on.
We're talking about algae.
Okay.
I think it's all these stormwater management ponds. You know, we put all these ponds everywhere for stormwater management. All we do is breed algae.
And mosquitoes. And mosquitoes, Steve. Don't forget mosquitoes.
Yes. And then they push all that algae into the bay. All these algae blooms in the bay have gotten more and more, common as we put in more and more stormwater management ponds that just breed algae.
Steve, do you know that we've had at least 7 sewage spills in Baltimore in the last several months?
Yes. Do
you know that we had one that went on for 10 days, 7 million gallons of raw sewage per day going into the Inner Harbor?
Yep.
Did you know that?
Oh yeah.
Do you know how many nutrients? Do you know how many nutrients are in raw sewage?
Yep.
I mean, seriously, do you know?
No, I'm sure it's a lot.
Yeah, well, so am I. There are tons and tons and tons of nutrients, literally tons and tons of nutrients. Do you know that we are dredging in Curtis Creek, and we are dredging in the Inner Harbor, and dredging up all that chromium and having all the heavy metals disturbed in the bay right now? Did you know that?
Yeah.
You know, it's a wonder where anything survives. It seriously is. Our caller last week wanted to blame the farmers for nutrient runoff off the farm fields. And we don't have to look any further than that sewer grate right outside our door.
Yes, exactly.
So, and Rudy brought up hard surfaces. Every time it rains, all that rain that's heated up by the macadam, the concrete, and all the crap that's on the concrete, all the garbage, all the fuel oil spills, all the the gasoline spilled at the local pump, all the oil that's in the parking lots. You see those oil stains around? That parts of that all gets washed down the sewer drain and into the Chesapeake.
But they also, all that oil gets washed into the sediment ponds. It sits there on the top. The first time it rains, it gets all pushed to the bay.
Yeah, that's true.
Maybe you should get rid of the sediment control and just let the water, off the hard surfaces. A little oil the first couple minutes of rain is gone, and the rest of the water would run clean.
What do you think?
I disagree completely with that.
Okay. There you go, Steve.
One of the reasons the sediment ponds do collect a lot of nutrients, but even if they didn't weren't there and didn't collect the nutrients, those nutrients would be washed into the bay anyway.
I travel Route 100 every day. I've watched them put in 20 new ponds along Route 100 that draw ducks and geese right to the end, both ends of the runways at the airport.
That's right.
We're going to save the planet, but one of these geese is going to take down a plane and kill a couple hundred people.
You may be right, Steve. I mean, they do have controls in place. They kill a lot of animals down there at BWI, deer and geese and critters that do threaten the planes. I can't remember how many strikes we had at BWI over a year period. Hundreds. I mean, it was unbelievable. Animal strikes.
Millions of tax dollars to put all these ponds right at both ends of the runway. It just makes absolutely
Steve, are you actually saying that you know more than government officials?
Oh, God.
You think you know more than our government, Steve?
Y'all have a nice day.
All right, buddy. Thanks. So you disagree on the sediment ponds?
Well, I do, because those sediment ponds are put in place to try to reduce the episodic pulses of water. The water collects in those sediment ponds and then is released into the bay in a more gradual fashion, as opposed
the pond has to fill up and overflow, basically.
Correct.
Or I'm sure there's some type of drainage out of the pond of some kind, but. Or leach through the soil, mm-hmm. something like that. Yeah, I see that. But, you know, I brought this up during the Nile virus scare we had several years ago. I mean, all the sediment ponds, I mean, they're just breeding grounds for God knows how many billions of mosquitoes here. And then we pay somebody like my buddy David to go out and try and control them. Mm-hmm. So, but I'll tell you, it's amazing. It's amazing. Wow. We're almost at the end of the first hour, Rudy. Hmm? Did you know that?
Good. It's getting close.
Yeah. Let's see. Let's get back to the hook and release studies with the striped bass. I know I sound like a one-trick pony here, but what can we do if the effective method is bucktailing? What can we do? I mean, do we just strike faster, set the hook quicker? Talk to me.
Okay. Artificial lures have a very, very low rate of deep hooking, comparable to circle hooks.
Okay.
So using artificial lures is a very effective way to catch and release fish without harming them, unless, of course, environmental conditions are stressful. But that's what we have originally was just artificial lures on the Susquehanna Flats fishery. We have included circle hooks now. But artificial lures, like I say, generally are not taken deeply, mm-hmm. and fish can be released, I can't say unharmed, but certainly with a high rate of survival.
More effectively.
Exactly.
And you know, again, if you're really fishing catch and release, press down that barb on the hook, and that does indeed make it a lot easier for you to remove the hook. And if you're on smaller fish, use a smaller bait, and you know your chances of catching more fish are better. And a big fish is going to hit a small bait just as well as he hits a big bait. I mean, you know, yeah, big bait, big fish, no question about it. But what happens when you have a ounce bucktail out there and you come up with an 11-inch striped bass? And you're focusing on bigger fish. You're gonna select a bigger fish most of the time, but you're still gonna catch some of the smaller ones.
Very true. And your point about having a barbless hook facilitates release, because some of the information we did learn in these studies is that people always associated warmer water temperatures, with higher mortality.
Mm-hmm.
And in freshwater, that's true. But as long as there is salinity present at even 2 parts per thousand, which is 0.2%, we did not see an effect of water temperature, normal summertime water temperatures, on survival. It surprised me. I really expected.
So you thought the warmer water would have more of a mortality than the cooler water, and it did not seem to matter as long as the salinity was there.
That is correct. What was a big shock to me was air temperature. I have a graph. Obviously, it's not going to come across on the radio,
right.
But it basically shows that early season, when we had fairly warm temperatures, we had very high survival of striped bass. And then in July, we had a spike of air temperatures going into triple digits.
Right.
And water temperature did increase to a certain degree. And mortality of shallow-hooked fish just took off from like 3% up to 17%. And when those temperatures came back down to more normal temperatures, water temperature didn't change. It stayed the same. But we saw mortality of the shallow-hooked fish drop back to almost zero.
Air temperature.
Air temperature. And more specifically, a big positive change from water to air temperature. So my point was, by having a barbless hook that facilitates release in the water.
In the water.
Yep.
It keeps you from pulling the fish out of the water into the hot air.
That is correct.
Amazing. Hey, goose hunters, if your season is not going as well as you had hoped last year, well, maybe it's how you're talking to the geese. Now is the time to take a look at SeanMann.com and check out the Eastern Shoreman Goose Call. SeanMann.com. I ran into Ed Henry the other day, who works with Sean on a daily basis, and we had quite a chat. And it was a fun time. We talked about Sean, and we talked about the Eastern Shoreman calls and goose season and things like that. I recommend you give Sean Mann a call at 800-345-4539, and especially log on to the website, www.seanmann.com. You know, Sean's local grown. He knows about Maryland geese. He still lives here on Maryland's Eastern Shore. His business is here. He actually started the long call revolution back in 1985. And if you've got a kid, an Eastern Shoreman call is very reasonably priced and very easy to learn how to operate. And you know what? If you've never operated a goose call, well, it's time that you pick up an Eastern Shoreman and learn how to use that one. From there, you can go on to any other goose calls made by Sean Mann or anybody else. We recommend the Eastern Shoreman made by Sean Mann. SeanMann.com is the website, www.SeanMann.com, or call them toll-free for more information, 800-345-4539. Check out the hunting opportunities with Sean Mann and Sean Mann Outdoors right here in Easton. Rudy, we've talked about the Maryland Fishing Challenge. You talked about tagging Diamond Jim. You've been on those adventures. Diamond Jim is out there. He's ready to be caught by anybody. He's worth $10,000. You didn't catch him the other day, did you?
No, we did not.
Okay. I was hoping you might have caught him, but even the imposters are worth $500. And anybody who's in the Fishing Challenge with a citation-sized fish or a tag striped bass, even go to some of these kids' events throughout the state, you may be picked for to be entered in the Fishing Challenge. Your kids might be picked to be entered in the Fishing Challenge, win a great fishing trip.